listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And boy, what a night. What a night. It's, and really kind of who knows. Because so many of the elections were done on electronic voting machines. We can't really be sure. I don't know how it is that the Republicans get away with casting aspersions on our electoral system. Oh, you can't, you know, there's an election fraud out there. We got to make it hard for people to vote. You got to have ID because people are fraud, you know, fraudulent. But they don't care about the fact that for-profit corporations are tabulating our vote. Oh, that's right. The head of Diebold, Wally O'Dell, said that he was going to deliver Ohio for George W. Bush. I had totally forgotten. Well, in any case. So, and we'll be talking about that a little more in the third hour as of our program when Brad Friedman drops by and we just get an update on, you know, some of the election problems that we're having in this country. But that said, what happened? What happened yesterday? Probably, you know, the guy who basically ran his entire campaign on taking down Obamacare was Ken Cuccinelli. I find this fascinating. When you kind of dig into the metrics of this, he said that Cuccinelli said that his entire campaign was about Obamacare. And Terry McAuliffe said that he would have Virginia take the federal Medicaid expansion, which has not happened so far in Virginia because of Governor Ultrasound Bob McDonald and Cuccinelli and company. So, I mean, this was the principal thing that this was fought on, that and women's issues, which arguably are almost all health care issues, and so you could say that it was really health care that kicked Ken Cuccinelli out of the governor's mansion. We're still waiting to find out if Mr. Obershane, this is what I find bizarre. Apparently, a lot of people went to the polls and they voted for Terry McAuliffe, the Democrat for governor, but they did not vote for, and Jim, do you know the name of the Democratic nominee for the attorney general? Now, Jim doesn't have that handy. I'm sorry, I don't know it off the top of my head either. I do remember the Republican is Obershane because he's quite memorable. He's the guy who proposed legislation in 2009 as a state senator that would have required women to turn themselves into the local sheriff within 24 hours of having a miscarriage, and if they fail to do so, they go to prison for a year. Now, that race is going to be recounted. We don't know yet who won. Mark Herring. Herring, like the fish? Or something close, yeah. Okay, Mark Herring is the Democrat. And Mark Herring and Mark Obershane. Is it Mark Obershane? Yeah, okay. So the two Marks, anyhow. Herring versus Obershane. So right now, Obershane looks like he's ahead 155 votes during the night. Herring was ahead. It's going back and forth and back and forth. But what it looks like happened in Virginia, and I think that this is a lesson that might be taken nationwide, is that a lot of women who identify themselves these days, now, back during the Kennedy era, they would have identified themselves, this would be largely middle-class and upper-middle-class white women, would have identified themselves as JFK Democrats. They then became Reagan Republicans. During the Reagan years, they were referred to as Reagan Democrats, but then they just, you know, held on to the Republican label. But then when they realized how crazy Cuccinelli was, I mean, how just genuinely crazy this guy was, the policies that he, you know, his misogynistic positions, his being against health care in general. If you just look at the vote, you know, the male vote, Cuccinelli won. If you just look at the female vote, McAuliffe beat him in a landslide. McAuliffe beat him by 2.5 points, which ain't nothing, right? That's not, you know, what's the old saying? It's not sliced something or other, but some kind of meat. Anyhow. But what that means is that the fact that this Herring-Obenshain race is so close, this is the attorney general's race, it's two steps down, and the attorney general in Virginia has a lot of power. The fact that that race is so close means that a lot of these women, largely white middle-class women in Virginia, went into the polling place and said, even though I think of myself as a Republican and I always vote Republican, I can't bring myself to vote for that Cuccinelli guy. So I'll vote for Terry McAuliffe. So they were basically voting against Cuccinelli, or they were voting in favor of Terry McAuliffe and saying, you know, I mean, here are the things. These were the explicitly the things that Terry McAuliffe ran on. Number one, women's health. He pointed out that Cuccinelli wants to ban birth control pills, not just abortion, but birth control pills, and wanted to close, you know, clinics that provide things like, you know, breast cancer screening and things. Number two, Obamacare implementation. Terry McAuliffe said, you know, he's running on this. Number three, climate science. Ken Cuccinelli is a climate denier, climate change denier, and LGBT equality. So anyhow, these, you know, the women went into the voting polls and they said, you know, I'm a Republican, but I'm going to vote for this Terry McAuliffe because I agree with him on these positions and I think Ken Cuccinelli's crazy. And obviously the amount of advertising necessary to inform them about the positions of the attorney general candidate was not there because they split their ticket. They voted for the Democrat for governor and the Republican for attorney general. Which is bizarre, because the Republican attorney general is more right-wing than Ken Cuccinelli. But apparently they didn't know it. Okay, minimum wage came out big. It looks like SeaTac Washington will know soon, but it looks like they've voted for a $15 an hour minimum wage. Now, this is where the SeaTac Airport is. It's their principal business. But still, that's a big deal, $15 minimum wage. New Jersey voted for a minimum wage. Now this is where, again, where it gets really interesting when you look at what the voters said versus what the candidate is all about. Chris Christie, the New Jersey State Legislature, which is Democratic, passed an increase in the minimum wage. Chris Christie vetoed it. The legislature couldn't overturn his veto, so the people, citizens, put it on the ballot. As a ballot initiative, it got 60% of the vote. And Christie won by a very large margin as well. So why would somebody vote for Chris Christie when they're opposed to his policies? I think that Chris Christie has the potential to be this generation's Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan, we all knew he was a right-wing crazy. Any of us who were politically active and paying attention, we knew that back in the 70s. We knew that in the 60s, for that matter, when he was governor of California. He made no. We knew that in the 60s. Actually, I'm not sure exactly when he became governor of California, but we knew that in the 60s when he was recording that album for the AMA saying that Medicare, which was created in 64, 65, something like that by LBJ, Medicare was going to lead to Soviet-style socialism. Right, we knew how crazy Ronald Reagan was, but he didn't campaign as a crazy. He did the dog whistle stuff, you know, go to Philadelphia, Mississippi, and give your opening speech on states' rights. So the hardcore racists, they knew what he was all about. And the hard right wing, they understood what he was all about. For the average low-information middle America voter, Ronald Reagan campaigned as the nice guy with the big smile. And when we come back in the break, I'm going to go through the positions that Chris Christie takes, what his actual policy positions are, and you will see that they are virtually identical to that day's Ronald Reagan, and yet he won.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And that's why I think Chris Christie could be in 2016 the next Ronald Reagan, although he's going to have his own Iran-Contra, too, to win, right? We haven't had a legitimate Republican president yet. And welcome back. Andrew Campbell, senior producer with The Big Picture, is on the line with us. Hey, Andrew, how you doing?
Thanks, Tom. How are you doing?
Great. Okay. We're going to start out with a rant. And do you know if Charlie Crist is confirmed yet or not?
He is most likely not going to be on tonight.
Okay. All right. Great. So in that case, we're going to open with the Lone Liberal Rumble.
Yeah, we're going to come in with the Lone Liberal Rumble, and we'll start off talking about Chris Christie's win last night, like you were just talking about. Really, people forget, maybe, but Christie opted to expand Medicaid under Obamacare, which at the time was seen as a huge political liability, not only for governor of New Jersey, but for any 2016 presidential aspirations. But apparently that turned out to be a good thing. So we'll talk about, is supporting Obamacare actually a good political move for Republicans that can build their support base?
Right.
Definitely an interesting thing to get into. We'll also be talking about Bill de Blasio's win in New York City. He crushed Republican Joe LaHoda, and he ran on a very strong progressive platform. And one of the ideas that he has is funding universal pre-K in New York City by slight increases on taxes for the wealthy.
Right.
There are tons and tons of millionaires in New York City, and really, can't they afford to pay just a little bit more for programs like universal pre-K?
Yeah, not just millionaires. New York City has a disproportionate number of billionaires.
Yeah, that's true, too.
Yeah.
Then we'll also talk about Sherrod Brown, Senator Sherrod Brown, pushing for a Social Security expansion.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll get into the head of AEI, which is a conservative think tank. He said that the war on the social safety net by conservatives is insane. I mean, this is a conservative think tank president coming out saying that Republicans have to stop this war. Very interesting stuff.
Good luck on that. Good luck with that. So that should be very, very interesting. Okay, and then we have Ambassador Anne Lamiala.
Yes, she is the Finnish ambassador to Mexico and some other Latin American and South American countries. And you're going to be talking to her about Finland's success with the carbon tax. Yesterday we talked about Ireland's successes and what drove them to introduce it. So we'll get Ambassador Lamela's take on why Finland saw the carbon tax as a viable solution to economic and environmental issues.
Right. And then we're going to do a walkout.
Yeah, we'll have a walkout on exit polling. Exit polls have sort of fallen lately. They're really, really not big anymore, but we'll get into why that is and really the importance behind them.
Yeah, we used to be able to predict elections with exit polls until we started having electronic voting machines.
Exactly.
Which is the not so much the topic, but I guess the hook for our daily take.
Yeah, you're really in the daily take. You're going to be talking about why this whole notion of privatizing our vote and letting corporations control our elections is just insane.
Yeah, and it's insane because the beating heart of democracy to literally the heart of democracy is the vote, is a verbatim phrase from Thomas Paine. And so to take the heart of democracy, the beating heart of democracy, and hand it over to a for-profit corporation whose interest is not in whether the election is accurately counted, their interest is in how much money they're making counting the election, seems to me like an insane idea.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, just plain old flat out insane. Anyhow, Andrew Campbell with the big picture. Thank you, Andrew.
Thanks, Tom.
Great to see you. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I should add the book is available in libraries. You can go to your, if you don't want to pay for it, which is a fine, you know, I'm all in favor of libraries. Go into a library and say, I'd like to read this book. Anyhow, Chris Christie, a moderate. I set this up before we went into the break, so I'm going to bounce these things off you, and then we're going to pick up David Selig. Chris Christie did take the Medicaid expansion in New Jersey, and he did create a state exchange. So that kind of puts him in the, arguably, Republican moderate camp. And this is why I say I think that he's the next Ronald Reagan. He's going to emphasize the things that he's done that are collaborative with Democrats. And he's going to de-emphasize things like the fact that for 3 years in a row, he has vetoed an a tax increase on billionaires in the state of New Jersey. 3 years in a row. He vetoed raising the state's minimum wage. He is opposed to women having control over their reproductive rights. In fact, he said at a rally in 2011, he said, speaking of Roe v. Wade, He said, eliminating abortion is an issue whose time has come. And he cut state family planning funding to Planned Parenthood. He vetoed marriage equality. He tried to block it in court. He's blocking climate change action in New Jersey. He pulled New Jersey out of this regional compact to reduce greenhouse gases. He's opposing gun violence reduction efforts. You can find all this over at the Center for American Progress's Think Progress blog. He opposed New Jersey. New Jersey has a you could buy one gun a month limit. Like, gee, everybody needs to buy 12 guns a year. He opposed that. People should be able to buy 30, 40, 50, 100, 500 guns a month if they want. Why are you going to buy those? Well, you know, there's a drug cartel that wants to buy, you know, who knows. Anyhow, he actually vetoed, while he did support the Medicaid expansion, he vetoed a bill that would let New Jersey set up a health exchange under Obamacare. Oh, so I was wrong. So Garden State residents do have to deal with the federal exchange. He vetoed that legislation. So he's not that moderate, after all, even on that. And he's put private schools ahead of public schools. So that's Chris Christie. This is David Selig, conservative commentator, pro-business advocate. His website's TrueTaxHelp.com. Hey, David.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me. And by the way, it was nice seeing you in D.C. over the weekend.
It was very nice to see you and have you on our program. So, David, and you're as impressive in person as you are on television and on the radio.
Thank you.
The city in which you live, New York City, now has, arguably for the first time in 30 years, genuine progressive as a mayor. And this has everybody all a Twitter. It seems like, you know, there was a time when New York City was doing really well. And, you know, I'm talking about in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s.
Oh, stop right there, Tom.
Okay.
70s was a very dark time. I mean, admittedly, I was only a teenager then, but the 70s in New York City was bad. I remember mountains of garbage in the streets.
That was the sanitation workers' strike.
Yeah, that was bad.
Yeah. Yeah, I started spending a lot of time in New York City in 74, I think, was probably the year that I first started, you know, doing business in New York City and going to New York a lot. And, you know, it's been up and down. But so what's your take on Bill de Blasio? He says he's going to raise taxes on billionaires by just a little tiny bit to pay for universal kindergarten. What's wrong with that?
Well, let's see if he does it, you know. I know a lot of people are very happy. Bill de Blasio swept into office, landslide victory. You know, he's promising a lot of things, but at the end of the day, I wonder if he's just another politician. We'll see if he comes through with it. You know, it's very enticing to get something for nothing, and that's what he seems to have run on. He said, if we would just take some more money from the rich and give it to the poor, sort of like Robin Hood. I don't understand why they stop there. Shouldn't somebody come out and just say, why don't we steal everything from the rich and give it all to the poor?
Well, you stop there because it's the reasonable thing to do, David. It's the American way. We did that, you know, through the years that you were a young child. And we did that before, you know, in your father's generation. That's what we did.
How'd that work out, by the way?
I think it worked out quite well.
No, because these individuals, when they get something for nothing, fritter it away very easily. They have no skin in the game, as it were. You know, every dollar you have, you worked very hard for. And when you're not in front of the camera, you're writing books that are published. People buy them, sweat of the brow, you know, the whole bit. But if someone was just sending you those checks, notwithstanding those big royalty checks you get, you probably wouldn't value it. And that, unfortunately, is the shortcoming with easy
David,
money.
I've been on unemployment insurance. In fact, I started my first business when I was on unemployment insurance, which I think is technically against the law.
Clear me, Tom.
Say what?
I said we were breaking up for a moment.
Okay. I've been on unemployment insurance. I'm glad that social safety net was there. When I was a kid and my
Absolutely.
Dad was working as a Rexer and World Book door-to-door salesman, we had to go to the cheese store, we called it, and, you know, get the surplus cheese. I mean, I've been,
well, sir. Tom, because you went there and you were induced by standing out there to get off your lazy rear end and get a job. Unfortunately, now we've concealed this. You have people sitting back on their fat rear ends, getting fat checks from the federal government, a.k.a. the taxpayer, and there's no degree of motivation and or shame.
I think people who are trying to make it, David, on food stamps are really how can you feed yourself on $1.40 a meal?
No, I can't, Tom. You've seen me. I mean, I'm, I have a battle with the bulge as it is.
But that's my point. I mean, I disagree with your characterization, but
okay.
We'll see how it shakes out. On that, I think we will agree. David Selig, thanks for dropping by, David.
Hey, thanks, Tom. See you soon.
Good talking with you. David Selig, TrueTaxHelp.com is his website. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Oh, and did I mention that the mayor of Toronto has admitted to smoking crack? But all the polls show that his popularity went up. A new political strategy? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and a remarkable day. A remarkable day. Whoa. Sorry about that, Martin. Somehow I... Let me... Well, this is interesting. My computer has gone nuts. There we go. Nope. Huh. I think I'm going to have to reboot this computer or something because... Oh, there. Martin's normal again. Okay. Four cities. Forgive my mumbling into the air here. I'm really sorry. Every now and then. We live in such a computer-dependent world. It's like... You know, this is the one thing that spooks me about flying these days is, you know, when I learned how to fly, I'm a pilot. When I learned how to fly, you put your hand on the throttle and you pushed it and you were pushing one of those cables that goes all the way to the carburetor of the engine, right? Nowadays, you put your hand on the throttle and you push it forward. And what you're doing is you're spinning a little potentiometer of basically a volume control, or something that's a little digital counter that is sending, you know, bits and bytes and voltages to a computer. That is then sending something off to a motor that is, or a solenoid in the, you know, it's like, woo. So anyhow, we so depend on computers and we do here in radio as well. And, you know, but, and I will get to your calls in just a minute, but I just wanted to finish this rant. First of all, my hometown, Lansing, Michigan, the place where I grew up. I was not born there. I was born in Grand Rapids, but we moved to Lansing when I was, I don't know, 4 or 5 years old. And, Lansing, Michigan, along with Jackson, and here's an interesting little factoid. The Republican Party was founded in Jackson, Michigan, at least according to one of two alternative histories of the Republican Party, in 1856, as I recall. The Party of Lincoln, it was founded as an anti-slavery progressive party. They lost the progressive part in the 1870s. But in 1856, it was started in Jackson, Michigan. They voted 60% yes to legalize pot. Lansing voted 63% yes to legalize pot. Ferndale, Michigan voted 69% yes to legalize pot. And Portland, Maine voted 67% yes to legalize pot. I'm guessing, I mean, Portland, Maine, Lansing, Michigan. I grew up in Lansing. I can tell you it's a blue-collar town. There's a lot of Reagan Democrats, a lot of Republicans. They have a progressive, you know, very good progressive Democratic mayor, but Lansing also is... You know, it's Republican headquarters in many ways. Jackson is even more conservative. Well, Jackson, actually, I can't speak so much about it. It's been a lot of years since I've been in Jackson. Ferndale used to be the kind of, you know, white suburbs of Detroit. I haven't been back to Ferndale in probably 20 years, so I don't know what the makeup of Ferndale is either. I can't speak for Ferndale or Jackson. I've spent a lot of time in Lansing, though. I go back there, you know, a couple times every year because my family all lives there. And Portland, Maine, you know, I don't know the makeup there, but it seems like I think with these kind of numbers that it's not just hippies or liberals or, you know, traditional pot smokers who are voting for this kind of stuff. Colorado voted to raise to use their newly decriminalized marijuana as a tax revenue source. Washington State. Tragically, this ballot measure that would have required companies to label their genetically modified foods as genetically modified, went down to defeat, which again just shows how, you know, if you're a big corporation, you spend billions of dollars scaring the bejesus out of people, it works. You can influence an election. And Scalia said it wasn't possible in Citizens United. You know?
Yeah.
So, anyway, this is the summary of the stuff that the large stuff that went on yesterday. So what went on in the elections? So some of your thoughts, Lee, and is it Weidman or Weidman, Michigan?
Weidman, Michigan.
Hey, Weidman. Weidman should have voted on whether or not to decriminalize pot, you know?
Yes, they should have, and it would have passed.
No doubt. So what's up, Lee?
Well, thanks for taking my call, Tom. I've been trying to get a handle on the individual mandate of the Affordable Care Act, and I'll give you a situation and then a question, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Starting in 2014, if a person chooses to pay the 1% fine in lieu of buy-in insurance, will they automatically be given an acceptable insurance policy, or will they be without a policy through the whole year of 2014? And the reason I'm asking this is because they won't have to pay that fine until they file their taxes for 2014 in 2015.
Right.
So I guess my question is just that. Will they be without insurance, and therefore if they go get medical attention,
they have to pay it out of pocket?
Taxpayers will end up paying it.
Yeah. I don't know the answer to the question, Lee. I think the given that this was passed when the Medicaid expansion was part of the law, this was before the Supreme Court knocked that down. The Supreme Court made the expansion of Medicaid optional for states, okay? So we have a different situation now than we had before. But when the Medicaid expansion was given, that every state would expand Medicaid, what that meant was that pretty much anybody making under $35,000, $40,000, you know, per family would get free or damn close to free health insurance. I mean, they get health insurance for, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of zero to a few hundred dollars a year. And so it would be crazy to not have insurance and pay the $95 fine or the 1% of income, which would be, if you made $40,000 a year, what would that be, $400? It doesn't make any sense. You know, poor people would sign up. And unfortunately now you've got states where, you know, like in Louisiana, in order to qualify for Medicaid, you have to make less than $1,800 a year. So if you make $3,000 or $4,000 a year, you don't qualify for the state Medicaid. And the federal Medicaid program, Bobby Jindal is refusing to take that money. And so there are people who are going to find themselves in that funny position of not having enough money to buy health insurance and yet facing a fine if they don't. The fine is essentially unenforceable. The IRS can take the money, but they can't prosecute you for it. They can't garnish you for it, those kind of things. They can't use the normal mechanisms that they would use for any other part of your taxes that are due. They can't do that with the ACA. So it's a soft tax as opposed to a hard tax. But the original intent of it was to say to people like the Koch brothers, you know, hey, you know, you made $1 billion last year, you know, $50 million last year. And on principle, you're not buying health insurance because you can buy a hospital. You don't need to, but just have, you know, you can. In some cases, some of these rich people actually do go into small consortiums and buy their own hospitals. And so, therefore, if you're not going to participate, we're going to take a percentage of your income, and it would make it cheaper for them to buy a super Cadillac $50,000 a year plan. That was the whole point of it. Because it just didn't make, you know, it was kind of crazy that people of modest means would ever be hit with that penalty because they'd have free insurance. But now that Texas and Louisiana and 26 other states, or 24 other states, 26 states altogether have said no to that Medicare money, or Medicaid money, excuse me, there are going to be some people who are going to fall into that category.
I see. Okay.
So, but how it's going to be enforced, I don't know. I don't know the details. And whether you have to be without insurance for the entire year, I'm pretty sure that you have to be without insurance for the entire year, and then you pay the fine in the following year. And you have to be without insurance because you chose to be without insurance, not because a health insurance company turned you down, because they can't turn you down anymore. So I think that's it. Lee, thanks for the call. Paul in Waltham, Mass. Hey, Paul, what's up?
I'm doing really well, Tom. Thanks for your hard work.
Thank you.
I appreciate your program. Mr. Selig was the last.
Selig, yeah.
Big
like the commissioner.
Yeah, he's a little out of touch as well as Mr. Christie, unfortunately. I want to speak about the voting machines. Those definitely need to go.
Yeah.
There's going to be more of a propensity for shenanigans to go on.
Well, I'm wondering, you know, given that Terry McAuliffe was running 5, 6, 7 points ahead of Cuccinelli, I mean, they were predicting a blowout. And there's two things that I'm not seeing any media coverage on. One was that the colonel who was in charge of Guantanamo.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this guy has a Twitter following because he's now retired, but he was the colonel in charge of Guantanamo through the Bush administration. He tweeted from the voting booth that he was trying to vote for McAuliffe and that four times he hit the McAuliffe button and each time the screen said, thank you for voting for Ken Cuccinelli. This is like that old Simpsons routine, you know? And there are several other people who were tweeting these kind of problems. So there's that. And then there's also, and this is just completely flown under the media radar, the fact that Governor Ultrasound and his attorney general, Ken Cuccinelli, knocked somewhere between 40 and 54,000 Virginians off the voting rolls before yesterday's election. So if you've got the attorney general winning by 151 votes, is this a George W. Bush situation? You know, his brother Jeb knocked 80,000 African Americans off the voting rolls, you know, just weeks before the 2000 election, and that got his brother George W. within spitting distance, you know, close enough that the Supreme Court could flip the election for him. Did knocking 40,000 or 50,000, and did they very carefully calculate the number that they had to knock off and in what districts? Did knocking all these people off the voting rolls in Virginia set up a situation where these down ticket races could be flipped Republican when they would have been, you know, more easily won by the Democrats? I don't know the answer, but I'm very, very suspicious of this. So, Paul, I'm with you. We need to do like Ireland did. I mean, Ireland sold, literally, they sold their voting machines as scrap metal. It's time for us to do the same. Well, they actually owned theirs. In our case, we just leased them. The company's owned.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Which makes it even worse, frankly, because it means when you're voting, you're not even voting on, you know, like the old crank machines. The government bought those machines. Now they're leased. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Tim in Grand Rapids, Michigan, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Tim, what's on your mind?
Yeah, good afternoon.
Hi.
How are you doing, Tom?
I am fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing. It's gloomy and raining here.
Oh, really? In Grand Rapids? Oh, bummer.
Yeah.
That's what happens in winter. You know, you're IFR more than half the year.
Yeah, I'm sick of raking leaves. I always voted. I've voted since I was 18 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Yesterday, we went to vote. We walked into a rundown school that we have been switched to. I've lived in the same house for 57 years. Okay? Mm-hmm. We walk in, my mother, my wife, I, and my son. And we fill out these cards and sign them. We take the cards from the table, and we take it over to the lady at the desk. She takes the card and asks for our driver's license. Okay? My mom's freaking because she doesn't know if it's current or not, because she doesn't drive anymore, hasn't drove, she's 80 years old.
Right.
So anyway, it was current. This time, they swiped it like you do at
like a credit card reader.
Gasoline station.
Yeah.
Yeah, like a credit card. They swiped my driver's license. I've never had that done before. Mm. And then they pass those two pieces of paper on to somebody with a paper ballot. We have paper ballots.
Mm-hmm.
And then they send you over to a booth to vote on whatever is brought up to be voted on.
Right.
I'm wondering, is there any other places in the United States that this happens? I've never had a swipe before. This
yeah.
is the first time.
Yeah, the ability to swipe a driver's license has become pretty ubiquitous. Police cars now have these built into them. When they take your driver's license back to the police car, they swipe it. It happened to me recently someplace, and I'm wondering if it was an airport. I'm trying to remember where it was, but somebody swiped my driver's license. I'm sorry, I don't remember. It's in the last year or two. But, yeah, expect to see more and more of that, because there was a standardization, a federal law that standardized driver's licenses that required, and if you'll recall, the media stink about it. This happened, I think, maybe about 6 or 7, 8 years ago. The media stink about it was that in one state, and I'm pretty sure it was Nevada, you could get a driver's license without your picture on it. And the federal standardization of driver's licenses was that they had to have a picture and they had to have a barcode, basically, and that was readable by other states, so that you know, you couldn't get out of state ID and use it in a state. And, you know, it was designed to reduce driver's license fraud, principally underage drinking kind of stuff, or people who have lost their ability to drive because of DUIs, you know, driving under a phony driver's license, that kind of thing. But yeah,
I see.
So
I blew a cord on it.
Yeah.
Because I never had dumped before.
Yeah. No, it's not the New World Order or some giant conspiracy. It's just, you know, it's the driver's licenses moving into the 21st century. And there really was a problem. I mean, there was never a problem of people, you know, voting illegally using phony driver's licenses. That just doesn't happen. But there was a fair number of people who were, you know, trying to buy alcohol when they were under 21, and especially on college campuses, they're all over the country. And a fair number of people who had lost their ability to drive because of DUIs who were getting phony driver's licenses, and they would almost always be an out-of-state driver's license because it wouldn't be as easily recognized in that state, or it's harder to pull up the records. So that's why they were standardized, I believe. Tim, thanks for the call. Okay, they say that Obamacare is unpopular, and in fact, when they did a poll, an exit poll in Virginia, what they found was that, you know, roughly 53% of the voters said, yeah, I don't so much like Obamacare. But 11% of those people who didn't like Obamacare voted for Terry McAuliffe. What does that tell you? It tells you that if somebody asked me, do you like Obamacare, I would say no. I mean, I think it's better than nothing, but, you know, I want single-payer health insurance. I want Medicare for all. So obviously about 10% of those people who are saying that they don't want or they don't like Obamacare are actually saying it not because they're conservative, but because they're liberals. So just, you know, an FYI. Kate, in Hackensack, New Jersey, listening on WWRL, you did not vote for Christie, but you were tempted to, really?
I was tempted to because of the whole New Jersey thing. And basically, nobody understands New Jersey. Nobody in the whole country except people in New Jersey. We are so having this private little psychological war with New York and have been for so many years that we wanted somebody who could stand up against New York because the whole 9/11 thing, we were not treated terribly well. The Statue of Liberty is really closer to New Jersey now. Does all this seem silly? But that's New Jersey. We are a silly state.
No, keep the list going. What else is there to that list?
Because Mayor Bloomberg went and put New York up for the Olympics, and what did he include? The Meadowlands. Now, the Meadowlands is definitely in New Jersey. And so him with the New York Giants. The New York Giants not only live in New Jersey, but they play in New Jersey. Same thing with the Jets. And we go on and on and on. So we took to Christie because he kept saying he was a Jersey guy, and in a way he is, and because he's not a racist.
Right. So bottom line is that Chris Christie, yeah, Chris Christie was standing up and saying, we don't get no respect, and damn it, I'm in your face, to New York, basically.
That's right, and that goes, and I've lived in New Jersey for, well, not 100 years, but very close.
For a long time.
This whole little thing's been going on. They're the Empire State. What do you mean? They didn't even vote for the Declaration of Independence. They didn't.
Really?
Really, no. That guy Morris was sent.
Governor Morris,
and
yeah.
He kept saying, I have no instructions.
Oh, you're talking about the Constitution.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, I'm talking about the Declaration.
Oh, the Declaration. Wow.
The Declaration of Independence.
Wow.
He kept saying that he had to abstain. You know, he would abstain. But then at the end, even after he voted to abstain, he said, I've got to sign this because none of you guys are going to get out of here.
Yeah.
Unless, and I will be included in this. So, I mean, it's a silly thing, But every state is entitled to its silly moments. Don't worry, Christie is never going to be president.
Yeah, the only representative from New York who signed the Constitution was Alexander Hamilton.
Well, okay, but you
had two from New Jersey. You had four from New Jersey: Livingston, Patterson, Brearley, and Dayton.
Yeah, but they did not sign by the fourth.
Yeah, no, I'm talking about the Constitution, not the Declaration. I've got to find the Declaration someplace else.
We've got to have the Declaration independent before we have the Constitution.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. It's just that the little book that I have in my hand has a list of who signed the Constitution, but it does not have a list who signed the Declaration, so I can't.
Well, I'm saying anyway.
But I believe you. I believe you.
You have to just say New Jersey is a silly state. You can't understand it unless you live here. I was raised in Ridgewood, a very Republican town all through the war.
Mm.
They were crazy about Roosevelt.
Yeah.
With a great many wealthy people in it.
Well, everybody was crazy about Roosevelt. I mean, you know, he got reelected.
No.
He got elected president four times in a row. I mean, it's
And the only other thing, I don't want to take up your time because I know people hate waiting, but the other thing, I love the thing on Higgins the Cat. That's what you should record.
Thank you. You know, I was thinking about this last night that I needed to tell everybody this last Higgins story, and I won't start crying when I tell this because
that was the beauty of it.
Yeah.
That was the beauty of it.
Well, okay, thank you. But here's, let me tell you about the other cats. We have two other cats in our house, on our boat. You talk about close quarters, right? I mean, the bathroom here in our studio, in our radio studio, is the size of the kitchen and just about the size of our bedroom on the boat. I mean, we live in, you know, basically it's like living in a mobile home. And we've got three cats and there's a very large, very strong, he's part Chowsey. He's a jungle cat. He weighs about, I don't know, 25, 30 pounds. I mean, big cat, right? And then we've got another cat that's more of a domesticated black and white furry cat. We call him Fang, and they're Mowgli and Fang are their names. And Fang is, you know, just a butterball. He's a little overweight, and we're concerned about what to do about that. But he's younger. He came into the family more recently. And they used to fight with Higgins. I mean, none of them fought, but they would mix it up, and they would compete for the food bowl and all that kind of stuff. When Higgins started getting sick, these two cats, when we put out food, they would sit there and watch and wait while Higgins ate, when he was still eating. They would move out of the way if he was trying to get to the kitty litter. They would move out of the way if he just walked up to the water. We get this little bubbling water thing. And if one of them was drinking and Higgins walked up, they would just move out of the way. And in the last week of Higgins' life, they would take turns sleeping with their backs just kind of resting on him, like, we're here with you. It just totally amazed me. All the competition was gone. They were, like, just totally supportive of this pal of theirs who was so sick. And, you know, you hear about, in nature, you know, the tooth and fang and competition and law of the jungle and all that stuff. I think it's nonsense. I think the primal operating system of nature is cooperation and love, because these two cats started showing love towards Higgins like I'd never seen among animals before, you know, during the last couple of weeks of his life. It was just amazing. It was just amazing.
Just sit and watch in the fall and watch a tree, a bare tree, and see all the birds come and get together to fly and how they wait for each other.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing that is alive on the earth that doesn't have the spirituality of whatever you choose to refer to it as,
yes,
God or spirit.
Oh, I totally agree. And that isn't driven principally by cooperation and love as a first principle. Kate, thanks so much for the call, and thanks for listening to WWRL. We will be back. It's coming up on 4 o'clock here on the East Coast. Patrice Hill, the chief economic correspondent with the very conservative Washington Times, is going to drop by. This should be interesting.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters: EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartmann.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartmann.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. 5 minutes, 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartmann here with you. And a fascinating article that appeared in the Washington Times, a very conservative newspaper, got picked up over at Newsmax. And, you know, variations on this have appeared over the years. In fact, the big variation on this was the story that we did a few weeks ago that made it big in the liberal side of the internet, which is that the average Walmart costs us about $1 million a year, costs the community, the local community, or taxpayers in the country about $1 million a year, because we subsidize Walmart's workers by giving them food stamps and housing assistance and other forms of assistance. That the whole McDonald's business model, we subsidize McDonald's. And the argument that was made was that, you know, we really should change at least our minimum wage laws, so that if you can't pay somebody a decent wage, a wage that on which they can live, I mean, Walmart workers literally cannot live if they buy everything at Walmart. They can't live. And on a Walmart salary, on a full-time Walmart starting salary. So, you know, that there should be some sort of basic minimum. And it turns out that, you know, we're paying on average $36 this is for the $50,000 household. This is the median household in the United States. That household pays $36 a year for food stamps and pays over $6,000 a year in various forms of corporate welfare and corporate subsidies. And about $1,200 a year of that is subsidizing Walmart and these big fast food companies via subsidizing their employees. But how did this come about? Patrice Hill wrote this fascinating piece. She's chief economic correspondent for the Washington Times over at the Washington Times. We may, in fact, I would guess that we almost certainly disagree on what we should do with this information, but I found the genesis of it fascinating. Patrice, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining me. First of all, do you disagree with any part of the, you know, what I've characterized so far?
No, I think, you know, the interesting thing about the topic is there's any number of ways you can look at it. You can look at it as taxpayer subsidies of the corporation. Republicans, as you know, are choosing to look at it as taxpayer subsidies of individuals who they think are not, you know, pulling their weight and sort of depending on government to get by.
Right.
So there's just a lot of different ways, angles you can look at this, and it's rather complex topic. And what I thought was interesting is that, as you said, the liberals have taken the view, actually very close to the conservative view, that this is taxpayer subsidies of corporations that was not intended by the welfare reform laws in 1996. But there are some Democrats, and I quote Jason Furman, the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, saying that this is actually what was intended by the welfare law, that, you know, the government would essentially be supplementing people's income. For people at the bottom end of the income scale, the government would be supplementing with food stamps, earned income tax credits, you know, Medicaid, all kinds of very lucrative and costly benefits,
right.
And that was actually contemplated when the welfare law.
Well, and at a certain level, and you write about this, he may be right in as much as at that time, prior to 96, and this was a collaborative effort between Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich, if my memory serves me right. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yes, I think those were the two of the principal players. Yeah,
yeah. That the goal was to look at multi-generational poverty, multi-generational welfare, and say, we're going to end that. We're going to break that cycle. people can only be on welfare for basically 4 years, or maybe it's 5 years. And after that, you've got to get a job. Now, we realize there's not, and now keep in mind, this was during the dot-com bubble. You know, there's a roaring boom. Unemployment was at 3.5-4% at the time, really low, whatever it was. And so there were jobs out there. So they said, you've got to get a job. And if the job doesn't pay all that well, we'll give you a little transition on the assumption that eventually you're going to get promoted, or over time you're going to get a little seniority, that these are starting jobs that you'll start out with. And, you know, a year, 2 years, 3 years down the road, you'll be making, you know, $2, $3, $4 an hour more. That's obviously not how it worked out. But, you know, in a way, this proves the old saw that the road to hell is paved with good intentions. You think?
Yeah, it's. I think you stated it exactly correctly, that it was supposed to be just a leg up, you know, to help people get started in the work world, and then eventually they would, you know, as you say, get promoted and move on and move above the minimum wage level. But it hasn't worked out that way, both because corporations are choosing to pay workers, even people with some skills, at this low wage, but also I think some of the people at this income level are not really doing what they could to develop their skills and get the education they need to move to better paying jobs. Hmm. So yes, it's
whether you want to blame the company or blame the individual, we can agree that the situation is not a good and healthy situation, arguably for the people or for the corporations, but perhaps most importantly, it's not a good and healthy situation for the taxpayers. That this several thousand dollar a year per family tax subsidy, basically, that working people are paying to subsidize poverty level wages, the people working at those wages or the corporations, depending on, you know, which way you want to look at this, glass half full or empty, that's not a healthy thing for our democracy, that money could be better used for anything from building roads to cutting taxes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, I think this was, you know, that was certainly not what people who got into this. Although, as I said, there is a camp within the Democratic Party that feel that is saying that this was.
Yeah, well, I would say that's the corporatist camp. Those are the corporatist Democrats, the Democrats who want to be in bed with the big corporations and take money from those big corporations and be subsidized by them. And
yeah, because, you know, if you recall, Furman even argued that if you force Walmart to pay workers so that they wouldn't get those benefits, in other words, that to basically pay them enough to make up for the benefits,
right,
they would have no profits and it would wipe out Walmart.
Right, which is
that
not.
That was his argument.
Yeah, but it's not true.
Well, you know, they'd have to. The only way it wouldn't be true is that they would have to raise prices. And
well, no, Costco competes with Walmart, and they start out at $40,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think that the difference is, and we had one of these guys on, the guys who own Costco, the two guys who started Costco and the principal owners of Costco are worth a couple $100 million, and they make a few million dollars a year. The six Walton heirs own more wealth than the bottom 30% of all of America. You know, in aggregate, they're the richest person in the world, and they're earning hundreds of millions of dollars a year. So just as stockholders, and they're not even, you know, they don't even own all the stock or even a majority of it anymore. So, you know, Costco, competes with Walmart, but they do it by taking less money for the owners. It's real simple. But in any case, that's you know, a whole other issue, I suppose. But so we have just a few seconds left, Patrice. You've done a really good job of identifying this. I want to recommend this to people. Welfare to Work Law Encourages Low Wages, Raises Dependency on Federal Benefits is the article. Patrice Hill wrote it over remind me of the newspaper.
Washington
the Washington Times.
Times.
Thank you. WashingtonTimes.com. And people can look it up. Solutions? Does anybody talk about solutions, Patrice?
Well, I think people are just starting to talk about it, and I'm not sure that they've even looked at it in the holistically the way we're talking about it. I think a lot of Republicans are just viewing it as a problem with overspending on welfare, and many Democrats are viewing it as a problem with just raising minimum wage. And
right.
Those are the two ends you have to look at, you know, in terms of trying to correct the problem.
Right. I agree.
So
I agree.
Probably it's really
Patrice,
one of those rare areas where you think they might actually be able to meet in the middle if
yep.
they were.
Hang on. Hang on just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Patrice, I totally agree with you. And Patrice Hill, the chief economic correspondent with the Washington Times, WashingtonTimes.com. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. I find that fascinating. You know, it's just like, you know, the unintended consequences of welfare reform are a new business model. Business is highly adaptable. They will always figure out a way to make a buck. And so, you know, if government changes the rules for welfare so that people can work and make welfare and get welfare, then, yeah, we'll lower the pay scale so that they qualify for welfare and we'll let the taxpayers subsidize us, says Walmart and McDonald's and Burger King and all these other, you know, on and on it goes. I just find it fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. Tanisha in Seattle, Washington, watching us on Free Speech TV. Hey, Tanisha, what's up?
Hey, what's going on? I'm having an issue with some things. I mean, it's been going on, but I just don't understand how the government gives the banks money to bail out, but in the process of them giving the banks the money to bail out, they still have not helped the people on whose homes are being foreclosed or who have been foreclosed.
You're right.
And it's like, you know, us being American people, there's like no reason why any of us should be poor or hungry or have to worry about education. And it's more or less like they're putting more money into surveillance than they're putting into education. And that doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, doctors, teachers, people who work for all these corporations, they had to learn from somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So for them not to pay our teachers or say that, okay, well, the parents of kids, okay, they don't get any money for the welfare. It's not hurting children or veterans or older people, but that's exactly what it's doing. And it's like you have trillions of dollars that have been put into all these banks, and they're not sending it through to us. We're not getting any help. And it's like that. It's just incredible on how we have these lawmakers that we consider to be on our side who have done nothing but turn their backs against us, and for what reason? And I believe that the only terrorists that are here in the United States are really our government, because it's like they don't appreciate us for who and what we are, what we do. We want to live. We want to be happy just like anybody else does. And it's like they're taking that opportunity for us every time they say, okay, just like
I would be very careful, Tanisha, about calling our government terrorists. I think and not because I'm afraid the FBI will tap my phone or something, but it's the reason why you don't use the word Holocaust, the reason why you don't use the word traitor, because you want that word to have a lot of power and a lot of meaning when you do use it. I would say that they are certainly not patriots, these people. You know, they
I say this much. They really have a war against us, then. Is that a better way to put it?
I don't think it's so much a war against us. I think that what they're doing is they're operating in the interests of the billionaire and the multimillionaire class. It's really simple.
So
and we're the collateral damage.
Right. And so what does that put us at? If we look at these lawmakers like they're supposed to be helping us, but then every time we turn around, there's another law that they're taking away from us, or I mean another right that they're taking away from us,
yeah.
Or we can't get a job.
This is why we need to get involved in politics. This is why you need to go to your local Democratic Party and show up and say, I'd like to volunteer. I want to become a precinct committee person. I want to help write the party platform. I want to decide who's going to be running in the primary. Maybe I'll even run in the primary. These are the things that you could do. Or join an organization like Progressive Democrats of America, pdamerica.org, that is outside the Democratic Party, that pushes them really hard. We need to get involved. We can't just complain. Tanisha, thanks for the call. Tom Hartman here. My book, The Crash of 2016, The Plot to Destroy America and What We Can Do About It, is now available at all fine bookstores. The Crash of 2016 is not just about the economic crash about to happen, but the way we'll emerge as well. Speaking of Walmart, Southern California Walmart workers are planning to begin a job walk. Well, actually, this was posted some time ago. It was supposed to start at 7:30 a.m. PST, which would have been 10:30 Eastern time, which would have been about 6 hours ago. 10 minutes short of 6 hours ago. We'll We'll keep you up to date on that. I'm going to try and track this one down. So your thoughts on the issues of the day and some of the topics that we've raised today. Bill de Blasio saying that he's going to increase taxes on billionaires in New York City. The agony. And welfare reform, the Bill Clinton, Newt Gingrich welfare reform, literally creating a new business model for Walmart. Is this good for America? Let's start that conversation. I think that's fascinating. I think Patrice did a brilliant job of reporting this for the Washington Post, or the Washington Times, excuse me. Denise in Chicago, listening on WCPT. Hey, Denise, you wanted to comment on David Sewitt's comments?
You know how long I've been waiting to talk to you? You are just amazing.
Thank you.
I just need to put that out there. Your intelligence and your fact-based information is just really, really credible, and more people like you need to be heard. Now, a couple of things. You were just talking about the last gal. I just want to point out that this stuff with Walmart is not new, and they all do it. Walmart was probably the model for this approach to the government subsidizing and us as taxpayers subsidizing. I'm in the food industry, and this has been going on for quite a while. And, and in fact, there was a documentary put on before it was Current TV, now Al Jazeera, but Current TV ran a documentary that was made in 2008, 2009, that identified this. And
are you talking about Robert Greenwald's The High Cost of Low Prices, his piece on Walmart?
No, I have a different opinion about I have no problem saying I will never step in a Walmart store because of these policies as far as not paying them wages high enough for them to survive, so they live food stamps, and they teach them this. They actually teach you that in your, when you get
hired. Oh, we had an example a week or so ago where a woman called and recorded the call, called McDonald's and said, you know, I don't make enough money to be able to feed my kids. I'm working full-time at McDonald's. What should I do? How do I apply for a raise? And the person on the phone told her how to apply for food stamps.
Yeah. Well, you should look at that documentary. I think Al Jazeera may still be running that documentary. And it's a few years old, but it's still the fact and the impact. The other thing I want, the reason that generated my call is your gentleman who started to characterize people on unemployment. I'm on unemployment right now. I went back to school, got my MBA. It's the only debt I have right now. To the federal government, or to my MBA loans. I graduated with honors. I also completed a food science certification. I was laid off of I won't divulge the company, but the company was a very large company, huge company, and going through restructuring, hiring people, letting people go, until the leadership CEO gets it figured out. So a lot of collateral damage, and I was one of those people moved. And now I've been looking for a job for 8 months. I mean, I'm telling you, Tom, I'm told that I've made too much money and they're afraid to hire me because I'm going to leave. Like, really? No, right. I want a job. So I'm told that because I'm accomplished and I'm just, you know, trying to reinvent myself to stay current.
This is what's called overqualified, Denise.
Yeah. Well, but the thing is like, you know, if I was, you know, beginning in my career, I would, you know, there's a chance that I'd leave after a year to go to. I mean, I've heard people tell me stories. Yeah, they paid for my MBA, and that was great. And then somebody else picked me off, and I went to work.
You know, there's a fairly large portion of the population who, when they're applying for jobs these days, don't include all their academic credentials because they will be identified as overqualified and not considered for the job. And so they don't point out that they have a master's in business administration or even that they've got a bachelor's degree if they're looking for a job that's going to pay less than $15 an hour. It's not that I'm suggesting you do that, but I find it a sad commentary on our times that people have to do that.
Yeah, well, dumbing myself down when I've worked my whole life to improve myself.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it's like, really? And then you, for the good jobs, and I mean, you know, I don't want to be in this cesspool of companies, and when you want to go for the good jobs, it's highly competitive, you know, and the way that companies look for people in the black hole on internet sites. So, you know, I'm doing more networking and I'm working my tush off. So that gentleman who thinks that we're sitting on our butts collecting unemployment checks, he needs to get unemployed and he needs to go through this experience. Because I'll tell you what, nothing burns me up more when I have got so much to offer and I'm rejected. Like you said, being overqualified and just wanting to work and accept lower salaries, you know, it's a challenge. And I get up at 7 o'clock in the morning. I volunteered for an association. Mm. I can't give out too much information. I don't want anybody to identify me, but, yeah. You know, I'm volunteering, I'm networking, and, you know, so I'm working for free, and I don't know many 30-year-olds that have to go out and work for free for them to find a job.
Amazing. Denise, you're in Chicago. You're being heard on WCPT by thousands, tens of thousands of people. If you would like, I can put you on hold, and Dylan can take your phone number. And if there are any employers in Chicago looking for a really good employee who's got an MBA, who might be overqualified but is willing to really, really work, we would pass that along to you. Would you like to try that?
Oh, I'll tell you what, maybe I can write this, you know, just feel good that this was more of a networking call and not me complaining.
Exactly. Exactly.
I'm networking. I'm radio.
There you go.
Why
okay.
not?
I'm gonna put you on hold then, Denise. And Dylan, not. it may take him a minute to get to you because he's answering calls.
But one last.
Sure.
Yeah, one last commercial, Denise. I've got experience. I have more to offer than I ever have in my whole entire career. And I'm just waiting for that company to grab me up and use me and utilize me so that I could make money for them and make money for me and everybody would be happy.
There you go. There you go. Denise, here is an able-bodied person really looking for a job who not only is qualified and smart, but even has an MBA. And Denise, I'm going to put you on hold here. Dylan will get your information. If there are any employers out there, you know, you can call WCPT or you can call us and let us know and we'll pass it along. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Now, on the one hand, I'm very, very wary of the show becoming monster.com or something. On the other hand, it would be so cool if we could help Denise get a job. So we'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you 28 minutes before the hour. And Pam in Vail, Oregon. There we go. Click the right button.
Again.
Hi, Pam. So what's on your mind?
Well, I just saw a thing on the Huffington Post that says that Rand Paul and Mitch McConnell are introducing a national right to work amendment to be added to the LGBT non-discrimination bill.
Right. Yeah, they want to. It's not going to go anywhere. But this is their thing. Let's make all the states that are not yet right to work for less states into right to work for less states. Let's turn America into a third world nation. That's the agenda of Rand Paul and Mitch McConnell. Surprise, surprise.
Mm-hmm. And I'm really worried that they've snuck so many other things in with things that look like they were good things, and then they stuck crud, you know, stuff that's just detrimental to the entire nation into things that it worries me that people won't know it and no one will do anything and it'll just go ahead and go on through.
This is a case where they got their fingers caught in the cookie jar. The fact that Huffington Post is outing it means that, you know, they're not, if they are successful in amending the bill with that language, which would boggle my mind. I can't imagine Harry Reid would allow that to happen. You know, it would take a majority of the Democrats to let that happen. Or at least it would take a small minority of Democrats to make that happen. If they were able to do that, I doubt that Harry Reid would let that bill out of the Senate. So I don't think you have to worry about it. It's the sad news is really twofold. One, that they're willing to put a poison pill into the, you know, rights for the LGBT community legislation.
Uh-huh.
And you know, now that it's on the floor or close to being on the floor, and two, that poison pill that they want to put in there, that they're treating it as if it's not a poison pill, that they're trying to say that there's some legitimate reason why the entire country should go right to work for less, when what we've seen over the last, since 1947, when Taft-Hartley was first passed, which allowed states to become right to work for less states, is that every time a state becomes a right to work for less state, people in that state earn less money.
Oh yeah.
And that state becomes more poor. And it's like, you know, the states that are right to work for less states, we call them red states. And we call them taker states because for every dollar that they send to Washington D.C., they get back a buck and a half, whereas the states that are places where, you know, you can have a union shop and you know, the real right to work for state, right to work states, the right to work for a decent wage states, the right to have a union states. Those states are, we call the maker states. You know, they're the blue states. They're the ones that for every dollar they send to Washington, D.C., they get back 80 cents. And it's just, it's an amazing, amazing thing. Pam, thanks for...
Is there any way for them to change it so they can't introduce things like that where they have to keep a clean bill instead of being able to add anything to it?
There are ways to require that legislation be done in a clean fashion. There are weird, arcane rules that have to do, I used to know the term, it's not sequestration, but there is a way to do it. You can only do it with bills that have to do with dollars. You can only do it with bills that last up to 10 years, and it's difficult, it's hard. Budget reconciliation, that's it. Yeah, budget, I believe. But Pam, I'm not enough of a parliamentarian to know to intelligently answer your question. Bottom line should be though that you would think that Republicans would be interested in the country working. I mean, if you think back to 2006, maybe 2007, when Medicare Part D was passed. Medicare Part D pays for people's pharmaceuticals who are on Medicare, and the Republicans championed this. They pushed this forward. And they pushed it forward for two reasons. One was that they wanted to get in on the Santa Claus game. They wanted to be able to give gifts to the American people to enhance their popularity. And they thought they'd try. This was their first try at it. And B, they wanted to do it in a way that would make a ton of money, $600 billion specifically, in extra profits for the pharmaceutical industry that was, you know, funding the Republicans who were pushing this legislation. And so they passed the legislation, and they put into the legislation that it was illegal for the government to negotiate the price of pharmaceutical drugs, even though the Army negotiates the price and Walmart and Walgreens negotiate prices. But no, Medicare can't do that. And Democrats opposed this. Democrats said, let's just do this clean. Let's let the government pay for prescription drugs, but let the government also negotiate for the prescription drugs, and then there'll be no necessity for a donut hole. And let's put it on the budget, by the way. The Republicans wanted to put it on the credit card, not put it on the budget. So it didn't even show up until President Obama came along and said, we're putting all these things that George Bush, you know, added to the budget, but didn't put in the budget. In other words, all these expenses that he ran up, the two wars, Medicare Part D, stuff like that, and the tax cut. None of those things were in the budget. And so Obama said, we'll put it in the budget. And then all of a sudden, Obama's budget's in the red, right? Everybody's like, oh, my God, look at that. So. But what happened was, even though the Democrats opposed that legislation and largely voted against it because they thought they had a better way of doing it, once it was the law, they said, okay, let's move on to the next thing. Let's implement this. Let's make this work. And there were, you know, in the first 6 months or so of Medicare Part D, there were a lot of hiccups. There were pharmacists that couldn't figure out how to make it work. There were problems with reimbursements. Checks weren't handled right. The website didn't work right. But the Democrats went along with it and said, you know, our job is to help govern this country. Our job as legislators, you know, we lost the election. We're in the minority. So we're, you know, George Bush is president. We don't control the House or Senate. So we're going to go ahead and play nice, you know, not nice. We're going to do what is best for the country. And this is apparently what the people want. So we'll give it to them. Republicans, on the other hand, when Obamacare gets passed, Republicans have done everything they can to obstruct this law, to destroy this law. You've got 36 states refusing to create exchanges, and the Republicans refuse to appropriate the money for the Obamacare website to work properly. Surprise, surprise, it doesn't work right. You've got 26 states that are saying, no, we're not going to take the Medicaid expansion because the Supreme Court made that possible. And so you've got a lot of people who are going to get really badly hurt. They're not going to qualify for Medicaid. And they, you know, they won't be, they don't frankly have enough money. They don't earn enough money to be able to buy money, to buy health insurance on the exchanges. And so, you know, young, healthy people won't be getting, it's a bad thing. But the Republicans don't have this notion of governing, like, you know, we're all in this together. Let's make this government work. They would much rather have their partisan victories and destroy the Democrats. And thus, I think this is why the president's popularity is sinking, is because this 6 years of Republican obstruction is starting to hurt America, and people are blaming the president because they're low information voters. And so I think your point, what you're pointing out here, Pam, and thank you so much for doing it, and a brilliant catch, that, you know, they want to attach to the, non-discrimination in employment against gays, gays, lesbians, transgender, bisexual people, or you know, what, however you define sexual identity, that they want to attach to that this rider that says every state becomes a right to work for less state. This is they're behaving like the Taliban. Nancy in High Point, North Carolina. Hey, Nancy.
Hi. Interesting conversation.
Indeed.
I live in a right-to-work state.
Right-to-work for less. Yeah, let's call it what it is.
Yeah, exactly. I call it right-to-slave labor.
There you go.
Yes, I have three adult sons now. My youngest turned 21 last month. When he graduated high school, mind you, I'm permanently disabled, and I hate it. I wish I could have my old job back at a court reporting firm in D.C. where I made over twice as much what I'm making now on SSI because I ended up disabled at 29.
Okay.
I'm still trying to figure out a way to work in my recliner from home.
Mm.
I hate food stamps. By the way, I don't get them anymore. Mm. That's what I was getting ready to tell you. My son, when he turned 18 and graduated, got a little part-time minimum wage job. My SSI now is $7.10 a month. They took our big fat $221 in food stamps. This is what I was getting on just under $600 a month to feed me and my son. And they say that this is why I called. I want to know if anyone knows what these people that are sitting around on their big rear ends getting big government checks are actually getting.
Right.
Because two adults can't eat on $221 a month.
Yeah. Well, that's where, I mean, I don't understand it either, because I did ask David. I mean, my understanding is that food stamps works out to about $1.40 a meal. And I don't know how you make a meal with $1.40.
I don't. And my son is 6.5 feet tall and weighs just over 160.
Yeah.
He rides his bike around 18 miles a day when he works. He's got two part-time jobs now, because another thing about this state is it seems like people, even like Food Lion, don't want to give you more than 28 hours a week.
Right.
You can't live on that, especially if you're making minimum wage.
Yeah. Yeah, it's this is that minimum wage economy that in some ways the Welfare Reform Act has brought us, in some ways just, you know, Reaganomics has brought us. It's the combination of the two. I say Reaganomics is probably the biggest piece of it. Nancy, thank you for illuminating our listeners and viewers. I appreciate it, and thank you for calling in. And for caring, you know, for caring enough to pick up the phone and say, you know, here's my story. We'll be right back. It's 15 minutes before you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Indeed. And by the way, a caller today is going to receive a free signed copy of The Crash of 2016. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Ed in Saginaw, Michigan, watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network. Ed, how you doing today?
Oh, not too bad.
So what's up?
You're the man, Senator. You know that? You should be a senator. But anyway, that's not my...
Okay.
I'm serious. But in layman's terms, do you know the difference between a million and a billion and a trillion?
Well, a trillion is 1,000 billion. That's about all I know.
Okay, well, here's layman's terms. I can sit there and give you a dollar bill every second for 12 days. That's $1 million.
Okay.
I can sit there and give you a dollar bill every second for 32 years, and that's $1 billion. There's a whole lot of difference between a million and a billion.
Right.
12 days compared to a lot of 12 days in 32 years.
Yeah. And so that's the difference between a million and a billion. What's the difference between a billion and a trillion?
3,200 years.
3,200 years? Oh, yeah, of course. You had three zeros.
Yep. 3,200 years.
So wow.
3,200 years give you a dollar bill every second.
Yeah. That's quite amazing.
It's just ridiculous. And
yeah.
People don't know that.
Yeah, that is truly amazing. Thank you very much for the info, Ed. Say what?
I got one more statement.
Okay.
Over half the people out there in this country have no idea what's going on.
I agree.
No idea. And that's sad.
Yeah. This is why the Attorney General, who's more right-wing than Ken Cuccinelli, might be able to pull out this race in Virginia. People don't realize that he's the guy who said that if a woman has a miscarriage, she has to report herself to the police within 24 hours, or she goes to prison for a year. I mean, that's about as bizarre as it gets. Ed, thank you for the call. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Sam, watching Free Speech TV in Point Pleasant, West Virginia. How you doing, Sam?
Greetings there, Professor Hartman.
That's Dr. Hartman. Thank you, Sam.
You're doing an excellent job on this debate.
Uh-huh.
The programs, why the government has the programs, because of the minimum wage jobs people has to do.
Mm-hmm.
About the HUD and the food stamps. And also, they got on-the-job training also between jobs. Once I had to get on food stamps and asked me if I wanted to work at the library because I had some training in journalism and that sort of went with it. And I really enjoyed working at the library.
Mm-hmm.
And the library head, Arnie Newton, he was wanting to hire me full-time, and he went to the commission, and they made a big stink, said, oh, we can't afford another librarian. And anyways, that happened.
Yeah.
But, you know, all these big companies and corporations, they get all that money to do this and that. And then when the little person gets a little money, you know, from government, they sometimes want to put you down.
The average American who makes $50,000 a year is paying $6,000 a year in taxes that is subsidizing corporations in America and $36 a year that is subsidizing food stamps. I find that mind-boggling. And that's for somebody making 50 grand a year. I mean, if somebody's making twice that or four times that or whatever it might be, you know, it's like it goes up, it starts going up exponentially. And these the corporate welfare is just, it's pernicious. Sam, thanks a lot for the call. It's nice to hear your voice. Good to know you're still with us. Thanks for watching there in Point Pleasant. We'll be right back. Before the hour, welcome back. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on what's going on in the world today. It's brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, where you can give a goat to help a rescued slave and get a photo of your goat, the person you helped. And Ellen Ratner is right here in the studio with us. Ellen, it's always nice having you right here.
Today, our Supreme Court reporter...
Hang on just a second. Your microphone doesn't seem to be working. Is there an on-off switch on it? It's on, but not on. Is it connected on the back of the board? I'll tell you what, Ellen. Let me just hand you the microphone, and I'm going to let you finish the segment with my microphone, if that works, okay? Yeah. I'll yell. How's that? But here, because we can't figure this out.
Okay. So, our very own shared reporter, Mr. Shane, was at the Supreme Court. I guess he wasn't at the Supreme Court. He's not well, but he was able to get all the arguments. This had to do with two women who brought up a case to the Supreme Court, the town of Greece versus Galloway. One of the women's name was Galloway. Apparently, they sat in back of the town area and heard these prayers praising Jesus Christ. They complained about it. We're told, if you don't like it, you don't have to sit and listen to it. They brought a case before the Supreme Court. There was an earlier case that said that constitutional prayer is allowed before meetings of various towns and that kind of thing. However, it cannot be coercive. So her attorney brought up this issue of coercive prayer at the town, and the question is whether these prayers were proselytizing, whether there's an establishment of religion under the Constitution, etc. And so this is what came up. Of course, my guess is we may get a 5-4 decision on this. I know. Apparently the town was unresponsive to her. They basically, or to the two women, they basically for 1 month had a Jewish and either a Hindu or one of those other kind of prayers, and, but would not, went right back to their, you know, in Jesus Christ's name, that kind of thing. So that came up before the Supreme Court. Obviously we're probably not going to hear about what the result is till spring, but I can guess, given the makeup of the court, it's going to be a 5-4 decision. That is my guess. Okay, so also the Federal Prisons Director today asked Congress to pass legislation on overcrowding and repeat offenders, saying that the mandatory minimum sentences must be reduced, and they are saying because this is causing overcrowding, overcrowding is causing problems. They want people both in a work program, which they said is an incentive, also reduces recidivism, and also the drug program. Now, I'll tell you, I know several people, including former Congressman Bob Ney, who have been through that federal drug program, and they all say it's excellent. Interestingly enough, anybody who has ever been through the federal prison drug program, either the females or men, and I know both, both of them say that it is probably one of the best things the United States does.
This is a program for drug addicts.
It is a program for drug addicts. That's right. You can get into it if you're using prescription drugs or if you're addicted to, quote unquote, addicted to marijuana or something. It reduces your sentence, but it also actually does put people into halfway houses and gets them going again. Okay, so the president also left for Texas today, not before Ted Cruz said that the president's visit to Dallas was his broken promises tour and that she should take his tour elsewhere because Texas was supporting and creating jobs, and this Obamacare was just reducing Texas's ability to be on its own. So Ted Cruz spoke again. Secretary Sebelius today testified before the Senate Finance Committee. They said that they, she said that they are making progress. Senator Pat Roberts of Kansas said she should resign, among other people who said she should resign. Of course, you know, the president, she did resign, and the president tried to take anybody else on. Then, of course, the president would be unable to appoint anybody new because they would prevent anybody new from being being made Secretary of Health Education, Health and Human Services.
One more cabinet secretary they could filibuster.
That's right. Exactly. And that's what they want to do. Okay. Atlantic, and I think you might have seen it over the weekend, it was in the New York Times, is reporting on a new book based on data from the panel study of income dynamics. 38.9% of Americans would live at least a year under the official poverty level, and 11.6% will live at least 5 years under the poverty level.
Wow, almost 4 out of 10 Americans.
That's right.
Are experiencing poverty
for at least a year of their adult lives.
That's astonishing. In the richest country in the world.
That's right.
More billionaires than any place else on
Earth. Right.
Phew. It's amazing.
Okay. So also the president today met with 16 Democratic senators. 14 are up for re-election. He was talking about the Affordable Care Act. And, of course, as I said, Secretary Sebelius said it would it has gotten a lot better. Now, I will just tell you my experience. I have not tried the federal page. I have tried the New York page several times this morning. I tried it again. And I just tried to register without even looking. And it kept saying to me that my time had passed for registration, and it had only been like 15 seconds. So New York still has a problem.
Ooh,
that is not good.
Not good, yeah.
Okay. The other interesting thing is that it looks like the Senate Judiciary Committee later this month is going to have a hearing on surveillance. This is Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont. He's saying that the Intelligence Committee faces a trust deficit. You think so?
Mm.
And he's concerned, he said, that the NSA has strayed and overreached beyond its core missions. So get
ready
for that.
It's interesting that we're having these conversations at the same time Ed Snowden can't get a passport.
Right.
You know, and John Kiriakou is in prison. And
And Ed Snowden, really, the European Union ought to give that guy a gold star and a passport to every single country.
Yeah, well, there's no doubt some in the EU who would like to do that. And a lot of people in the Green Party.
Well, yes, and they met with him.
There you go. Yep. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Yes, my microphone is working now, too. So thank you, Ellen. Indeed. Thank you, Ellen. Thanks so much. And we'll be back with more. In fact, we're going to be back with Brad Friedman right after this. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And I've been saying for some time that I think that the greatest crime against democracy is not the privatization of our prisons, although that's pretty bad. It's not the privatization of 70% of our intelligence. That's pretty bad. It's not the privatization of so much of our military, perhaps certainly well over 50% of our military functions. That's pretty bad. It's the privatization of what Thomas Paine referred to as the beating heart of democracy, our vote. And of all the journalists in all the world who have been on this case more than any other who would walk into this bar, Brad Friedman, a publisher of the Brad Blog, bradblog.com, Twitter, The Brad Blog, and at Brad Friedman. Brad, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Tom, great to be here. By the way, I'm not at Brad Friedman, so we don't want to punish whoever that might be on the Twitters.
Oh, okay.
By sending them hate tweets, as I usually get.
Okay, so it's at The Brad Blog.
That's correct. That's correct.
Okay, great. Tell us, what is the current state of the information that we have about the difference between the exit polls that we're doing and the actual results that are being recorded on our electronic voting machines? We know that these numbers, before electronic voting machines, the exit polls were quite accurate in predicting the outcome of elections, that with the advent of electronic... Actually, why don't you go through that rather than me?
Well, concern really began to focus on the exit polls versus the election results back in 2004, when you had all of these states... these swing states that were supposed to go for John Kerry ended up going to George W. Bush. And of course, at the time they said it was the exit polls that were wrong. It wasn't the actual results. They had no real evidence for that. In fact, they had bad evidence that they tried to present. And then what you've seen over the years is fewer and fewer exit polls and less access to the data in those exit polls. They're really keeping them secret from the public. They use them when they want to use them for the purposes they want to use them, but they don't let us see it. But, you know, when you talked in your introduction there about the privatization of the voting system itself, that's really at the heart here. And I would go so far as to say not just the privatization, but with it the secretization, if you will, of our voting system and the inability for voters to actually oversee the results. And that's exactly what we're coming crashing up against, I'm afraid, in Virginia today, the day after yesterday's election there, particularly now in this Virginia's attorney general's race.
So what is the spread? What is the difference between what the exit polls said happened in Virginia and what the electronic voting machines said happened in Virginia?
Actually, we don't know. We don't know yet, and we probably won't know the difference between the exit polls and the actual election results because they don't release that raw data. It's very selective data that they now release. You've heard, you know, young voters, turned out in a higher percent than they right. did 4 years ago, that sort of
Before thing. The 2004 elections, though, they routinely released that raw data, didn't they?
Oh, yeah, you'd be able to get that raw data. I mean, it was that raw data that leaked out on election night on 2004 that everybody pointed to and said, look, this is how we know that John Kerry likely won these states. Now, but exit polls are not perfect. Don't get me wrong. They are better than the pre-election polls, but because, you know, they're asking people when they walk out of the polls, how did you vote? But, but they're not perfect. But when you see in state after state after state, all of them, quote unquote, failing in one direction, it's certainly going to raise eyebrows. But it also underscores, Tom, the need to oversee our own results so that we don't have to guess were the results right, were the exit polls right. And, you know, I mentioned Virginia. We're looking at an attorney general's race there. This was the only one that the Republicans may pull out. We'll see. 2.2 million votes cast. About 300 votes, last I checked, separated the Republican and the Democrat. It's almost certain to have a recount, or I should say a quote-unquote recount, because most of the state of Virginia cast their ballot on 100% unverifiable touchscreen voting systems. There's nothing to recount, Tom. It's been privatized. You can't look at the machines. But even if you could, there's no way to know that any single vote cast on one of those machines actually reflects the intent of the voter. So, I mean, it's going to be really a pretend recount in the state of Virginia. The voters will never know who really won and who really lost that race. And Virginia's not alone. We have that same problem all over the country.
Now, Brad, I'm guessing you've probably had an experience similar to this. I have sat down with fairly heavy hitters in the Democratic Party, shall we say.
Mm-hmm.
And said, you guys should do something about this. I mean, you know, this, and I'm not trying to be paranoid here, but, you know, just in principle, just the principle that the vote has been privatized is wrong. We should make the vote once again part of the commons. I mean, my mom was one of those election people where she, you know, went down and she checked your name into the book, and they would stay up until the wee hours of the night counting ballots. I mean, they would just, that's what they did. And it was just, you know, it was the people in the neighborhood did it. They volunteered. People volunteered. And they were overseen by, you know, she had a Republican over one shoulder and a Democrat over the other as she was counting ballots. We no longer do that. We no longer have this visibility. And the response that I get from the Democratic Party officials and from elected Democrats is, we don't want to talk about that because if people don't trust the vote, they won't show up to vote. Now, Republicans have made an article of faith about not trusting the vote. If a Republican lost, it's because there were 10,000 Latinos, illegal aliens who were bussed in and illegally voted, and Acorn did it all, right? I mean, the Republicans have made this an article of faith and have gotten laws passed in double-digit states to suppress the vote as a consequence of it. They've actually turned, you know, doubting the vote into their favor.
Yeah.
Why, you know, is there anybody who's talking about this? There was, you know, a point in time, I mean, Bernie Sanders, people call the show and Bernie's on Friday, and he will always say, we need to scrap the machines and go back to paper. But I don't know anybody else who's really doing this as an issue. Do you?
As far as elected officials,
yeah.
No. You know, they are concerned, or they say they're concerned about things like lines, things like voter suppression, and, you know, rightfully so. They should be concerned about it. And it's interesting, by the way, that Republicans actually turned the idea of lack of confidence in voting into reasons to institute these laws. They created this lack of confidence by pretending that people were illegally voting at the polls. And then the Supreme Court said, well, you know what? People are afraid illegal people are voting at the polls. So it's okay to institute these laws even without evidence that they are doing so. So the Republicans used this lack of trust that they made up out of whole cloth to get the laws they needed passed, while the Democrats, you're right, it's really perverse when they say we don't want to talk about this because people won't trust the vote and then they won't show up to vote, I mean, I have seen over the years as the politicians continue to not talk about this stuff, I have seen less and less confidence in the results in election after election. Right. You constantly hear people screaming for a recount, you know, charging that there was problems with the electronic voting systems. If you want to instill confidence in the results of elections, I would argue, let the people oversee their own results. I think that's right. The only way to...
Well, the other thing I'd like to know is, you know, there was a 50,000 voter purge in Virginia just a week or two ago. And an exit poll would show how many of those people who were purged were given placebo ballots. And to the best of my knowledge, that question isn't showing up on the... So there's so much data that we could be getting with good exit polling. Anyhow, Brad Friedman, for our listeners on KPFK in Los Angeles, be sure to stay tuned because after our show is over, Brad's going to be back on KPFK discussing this issue. Brad, thanks so much for being with us.
Great talking to you, Tom.
Great talking with you, Brad.
Hang this is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's Twitter at TheBradBlog, and of course the website is bradblog.com. Brad Friedman. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and... Well, that's interesting. I think this is the first time ever that we've gone into a Free Speech TV break without a single caller from Free Speech TV. And I don't want to put our commercial station callers on the air right now because they're not live on the air. So let me just riff on this topic a little bit. I think that, you know, Brad has identified a real issue here that needs to be attended to. We need, Ireland sold their electronic voting machines. They bought into this for a while, and they tried it out. They sold their machines for scrap metal. Canada tried it out and dumped their machines. We need to dump our machines. We need to say, enough already, voting is not an opportunity for Republican-controlled companies to make hundreds of millions of dollars. And they are. They're making a huge profit. The Help America Vote Act, the HAVA Act, was funded with billions of taxpayer dollars being given to the states so that those states could then buy voting machines from private for-profit corporations. And that's just wrong. I mean, it's just fundamentally wrong. Okay, the other thing I wanted to share with you is Unraveling the Virginia Spin. This is a really good blog that that Marcos Melitzis posted over at Daily Kos. Here are some of the stories, some of the spin that you will hear in the media about Virginia. Yeah, Terry McAuliffe didn't win in a landslide, so Obamacare is in trouble because he campaigned on Obamacare. Now, Marcos points out some polls said that Terry McAuliffe would win by 16 points, and the polling was 7 points up going into the election, which makes me wonder about the voting machines in Virginia. But still, you know, it has been 36 years, he says, since the party holding the White House won a Virginia governor's race. Yet despite running a flawed candidate in an off-year election when already the flawed candidate, by the way, being Terry McAuliffe. Terry McAuliffe, you know, Democrats are not all that enthusiastic about Terry McAuliffe because most of his life he's spent being basically the fundraiser for other Democrats, particularly Bill Clinton, but for other Democrats. And being a fundraiser isn't, you know, doesn't have the nobility associated with it. And he also had, you know, a business that kind of went south. And he's just, you know, he's not the knight in shining armor. He's an okay guy. He's a reasonably good politician. I've met him a couple of times. When he had a book come out, he came on our program. He's, a very personable guy, but, you know, comes across a little bit like a used car salesman. So, you know, the Democrats were not, you know, this was not the very best candidate ever, but he was a Democrat, and he won. Okay, exit polls showed Obamacare unpopular. It's true, Marcos notes. Virginia exit polls showed that voters disapproved. But 1 in 10 liberals disapprove of it. This is a 53-46 margin. 1 in 10 liberals oppose the Obamacare law because it's not good enough. It's not liberal enough. It's not Medicare for everybody. So actually, if you look at the polling, McAuliffe's Cuccinelli's extreme opposition to Obamacare hurt him. Another, the GOP establishment abandoned Cuccinelli. Rumors are flying fast and furious about this. Now, he wasn't particularly good at raising money, and yes, he was outspent. But, you know, the fact that McAuliffe won so narrowly, even though he massively outspent Cuccinelli, according to Marcos, is suggesting that, you know, maybe this idea that the amount of money spent, maybe there's a threshold beyond which it really doesn't work. And available for free in libraries. So we had the Washington State election results. Disappointing in Washington State, the GMO labeling initiative did not pass. Mark Taylor Canfield, a reporter from Seattle, on the line with us. Hey, Mark, what happened in Washington?
Well, first of all, it was good to hear Brad Friedman on the show. I was actually on the broadcast last week talking about these elections, and today I'm writing at Daily Kos. But, yes, it is disappointing. There's good news and bad news. The good news is that the big coal industry got a black eye when voters in Whatcom County elected four Democrats. So they have all said it ahead of time that they were going to vote against giving a permit to the $600 million Gateway Pacific Terminal in Bellingham, which would have been the port where coal mining companies would have exported 48 million tons of coal a year to China. So big coal suffered some major setbacks all across the country on some of these statewide ballot measures.
Hmm.
Another good news story is that the city of SeaTac, just south of Seattle, is voting currently in favor of a new $15 an hour minimum wage, which is another issue that has received a lot of national attention.
Now, has that been nailed down yet, or are they still counting the ballots?
They're still counting ballots, Tom. I should be clear here that this is an all-male balloting system in Washington State, so it will actually take probably till the end of the week to get a really final count. A lot of folks dropped their ballots off late on Tuesday night, last night.
Right.
So some of these numbers could change, but the trends are looking pretty clear. And one of the bad news stories is that Washington State's Initiative 522 to label GMO food is failing at this point. So it looks like Monsanto, DuPont, and the Grocery Manufacturers Association were once again able to convince a majority of the state voters, like they did in California, that, you know, GMO labeling is somehow unwise. So there are millions of dollars in negative ad campaigns.
I understand, Mark. I mean, you live in Washington State, and I don't, so I haven't seen these ads. But I've seen reference to ads that were done by organic farmers who said, I'm an organic farmer, and I'm opposed to this labeling bill. Is that true?
I can't really speak on that because I've been busy covering the Washington State Attorney General's complaints against the Grocery Manufacturers Association for hiding $7 million in contributions to the No on I-522 campaign. But they have been, in the eyes of a lot of the Yes on 522 activists, very deceptive ads. They've hired people who are nurses and farmers and anybody they can find, you know, and the money is just poured into the eastern part of the state, which tends to be more conservative. There's a lot of Republican voters there.
Right.
So that was very successful in that part of the state, at least.
Right.
By the way, we have a new mayor. Ed Murray, a former state legislator, is now the new Seattle mayor. He beat incumbent Mike McGinn, largely on issues of reforming the police department, which was under an 8-month Department of Justice review because of excessive use of force. And also the self-proclaimed Occupy Movement candidate for city council, Gashama Sawant, actually lost her bid to be the first socialist member of the council in recent history. But she came so close in the polls that they're still counting the votes. And it's definitely it's taken the monopoly away, I think, that Richard Conlon has had on that seat in Seattle for years and years now.
Hmm.
And also Seattle, the city, did approve a public financing of city elections.
Hmm.
So there's good news and bad news. And some of it is really disappointing in terms of the Initiative 522 votes, but the fact that the coal industry kind of got a black eye and that a $15 an hour minimum wage has been instituted in SeaTac is a good thing. And by the way, Tom, you were mentioning tax subsidies for major corporations earlier. Governor Jay Inslee just called a special session of the Washington State Legislature because Boeing is demanding continuing tax subsidies. So there you go. There's a perfect example.
So, yeah, the average person, the median income in the United States, $50,000 per household, $36 a year of that goes to pay for food stamps. Of your tax bill, $6,000 a year of your tax bill goes to pay for corporate welfare. which includes corporate welfare for Boeing in that area. That's very interesting. Mark, thanks a lot for the report.
Thanks, Tom. Keep up the good work. Always great show.
You too. Thank you, Mark. Thank you very much. Marty in Evergreen Park, Illinois. Hey, Marty, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, sure. Well, first off, I still think that Anonymous prevented Karl Rove and Romney from stealing the last election. I still
by hacking the hack?
That, but, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I believe they totally were planning on hijacking that stream and manipulating it, but I have yet to prove that, and thank goodness it didn't happen. But
yeah.
Voting machines have got to go. But on a side note, I wanted to give a shout out to Illinois for, I believe, being the 15th state now to legalize same-sex marriage. And, you know, that's a pretty big victory here. And hopefully marriage equality will spread throughout the country.
It is. And you know, well said. And I totally, totally agree with you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Marty, for the call. Donna in Longmont, Colorado. Donna, we got a minute to the break. It's all yours. What's up?
Hi, I just wondered how they could say that money is free speech and then tax money.
Oh, that's an excellent question. If you read the Supreme Court decision, they actually did it with pretzel logic, upside down, inside out logic. They said that corporations are more well informed about economic factors than normal people are, and so if you and I are prevented from hearing the information that corporations can share with us, we are less well-informed, and so our ability to listen has been diminished. And listening is part of free speech. So they didn't actually say that money is speech. They said that the money that is speech becomes the speech that we listen to, and so we as individual humans have our ability to live in an environment with a lot of speech in it diminished if we regulate money. That's how they did it. So the logic that they used, because your question is so perfect, it's absolutely perfect on it. If money is speech, how can they tax it, or why don't they tax speech? You know, is perfect. But you have to read it. It's in my book on equal protection. It lays it all out. Unfortunately. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And these right-wingers on the Supreme Court, in addition to being the kings of America, and the five of them are men, they're also very, very slow. So Anthony Scalia, in the hearings today on whether or not there should be prayer in public meetings, said, what about the devil worshipers? And everybody laughed. And I'm sitting here going, why did everybody laugh? I mean, what about the devil worshipers? I think one of the fastest ways to stop public prayer would be for the devil worshipers to be able to have their prayers. Where they get up and they start praying to the upside down star, the God of the upside down star. That's now on the Republican logo. Right? What about the devil worshipers, the Republicans? He says, what is the equivalent of prayer for someone who is not religious? There are many people who do not believe in God. If you had an atheist town board, you would not have any prayer, I guarantee you. Yeah. Of course. He says, in the gospel, the devil is doing all sorts of things. He's making pigs run off cliffs. He's possessing people and whatnot. And that doesn't happen very much anymore. All right. Very interesting. Richard in Evanston, Illinois. Hey, Richard. Thanks for listening to WCPT.
Hey,
what's up?
Yeah, boy, a lot of things. You know, if you took Gates' money and divided it by the number of people, it was about $200, just to go back to what one of those other guys mentioned. But, boy, so many things have been going on since I called in. Thinking of the troubles that everybody's complaining about with the Obamacare and the machines, et cetera, you would think that the voting machine problems would be stirring up equal concern by the Republicans, huh?
Maybe we should start a rumor that the that Anonymous hacked the voting machines in Virginia. The problem is that the polls were showing Terry McAuliffe ahead by 14 points, and he won by 2.5 points. So, You know, it's like whenever you have a difference between polls and outcome, the outcome always favors the Republicans. And Matovsky of Edison Matovsky, you know, one of the big polling companies, he came up with this theory back in 2004 to explain this. He called them the bashful Republicans. He said Republicans are so embarrassed by George W. Bush because he's such a terrible president that they were embarrassed to admit that they voted for him. And that's why the exit polls in 2004 showed that Bush lost in four or five states where the electronic voting machines gave the states to him, thus allowing him to beat John Kerry, including Ohio. And I don't believe the bashful Republican theory for a minute. But anyhow, you wanted to talk about the about
FDR, actually.
FDR, yeah.
You mentioned something about FDR, but I also mentioned Lowell Weicker, who said he was against school prayer. He's a Republican from Connecticut.
Sure.
He said that if you force a person to pray, it's not free prayer. You can pray anytime you want.
Yeah, Barry Goldwater as opposed to school prayer.
Weicker.
So is Barry Goldwater.
But FDR. Yeah, FDR. I've read a book called Trading with the Enemy, and it's about FDR. And you said that everybody loved FDR. In 1934, a whole bunch of people like the Koch brothers of the time, DuPont and others, tried to overthrow him. They went to a guy named Smedley Butler, who has two Congressional Medals of Honor, and he was they wanted him to lead a large army to threaten FDR to turn over the presidency to some other appointee.
Yeah, they had organized over 500,000 right-wing veterans who were going to march on Washington D.C. and run FDR out of the White House, and Smedley Butler blew the whistle on them. There were congressional hearings, and FDR got the congressional hearings stopped after 5 or 6 days, and a lot of their findings sealed. Smedley Butler went on to write a book called War as a Racket, which wasn't so much about that; it was more about his days prior to that. But he was the most famous Marine in America at the time.
Yeah. It's also they wanted the gold standard. They returned and they wanted free trade. And I mean, it was very similar to now, where a small bunch of people, Rene DuPont, Morgan Bank, GM had their president, Knudsen, K-N-U-D-S-E-N, other people were all part of this plot. And they were
allegedly.
Well, it was declassified in 67, and the guy wrote about it. I just was online looking while I was waiting. It verified Butler, and it was all laughed off because, you know, at the time we were trading with the enemy, and that FDR wouldn't take on many of the corporations like Standard Oil and others.
Right.
Because and the ball bearings even that were being produced in this country were being shipped to Germany during the war through Central.
Well, 1934, there was no war, and in 1934, Hitler had just come to power. It was it was late in 1934 when he invaded Poland. It wasn't early 1934, the Sudetenland, when he went into Czechoslovakia.
But this book extends on through the war. That's why I guess I jumped to that one. You're right. It wasn't the war at the time, but they were making all these links at the time. So anyway, I just want to say not everybody loved FDR.
that's you're absolutely right. And my father, oddly enough, hated him his whole life, which I always scratch my head. My grandfather loved FDR. In fact, his only complaint about FDR was that he wasn't enough of a socialist. Which might be why my father hated him. I don't know. But anyhow, Richard, thanks a lot for the call. Steve in Haymarket, Virginia. Hey, Steve, thanks for listening to Sirius. What's up?
Yeah, I worked the polls from 5 o'clock on, and it was 10 to 1 for Ken Cuccinelli.
Where?
As far as people walking. It's at Disney in the Haymarket area there at the where Disneyland was going to be, or Disney's America was going to be, that polling place. So, I mean, it's an affluent area, and I kind of figured that there were going to be offsets in other areas in the state. But
sure.
The point is, and I don't really like, they were talking about raising taxes in Prince William County to get more voting machines. I said, well, we just get like bottles of ink.
Yeah, well, let's go back to paper and pencils.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that worked fine in this country for 200 years, and now we're you know, the Help America Vote Act handed $6 billion to five corporations to manufacture machines to solve a problem that didn't exist. You know, it's
exactly.
And even
those stupid number two pencil tests, those were idiotic at the time. Write it on a piece of paper and turn it in.
Yeah. Yeah, and then have people like my mom count the vote. You know, it's what my mom used to do. And it took you a day or two to figure out who actually won. I mean, the votes in Germany to this day, it takes 4 days for the votes to be counted because civil servants who are non-essential, you know, take off their regular jobs and they do that vote counting job. And but, you know, it takes 4 days for the count. But they know the within 5 minutes of the time the polls close who won, because their exit polls are never off by more than a tenth of a point. And exit polls traditionally have never been off. The Carter Center does exit polls around the world to determine whether or not an election is legitimate. We determined the legitimacy of the initial elections in Iraq and Afghanistan based on exit polling.
And on their
but we don't use them here.
Yeah, I'm using sample ballots, and I'm handing them out, and I'm standing next to the Democrat. He's handing out sample ballots, and, you know, we had a kind of a good day, you know, talking to each other, and, you know, it wasn't a debate. It was just sort of like, you know, the thing that we agreed on became more of the subject than, you know, being argumentative.
Oh, we're all Americans here, Steve.
Yeah, it just sort of like seemed like, you know, having a bunch of Democrats and Republicans in one room discussing the voting situation, what could possibly go wrong?
With the machines, what could possibly go wrong, I'd say. But, you know, good on you for showing up and for volunteering, even though it was for the Republicans. Good on you, Steve. I share I admire your civic mindedness. Thank you very much and thanks for calling and sharing the story. Howard in Hollywood, Florida. Hey, Howard.
Hey, Tom. Tom, I don't know if you know Clint Curtis or not, if you know that name.
Clint Curtis, was he one of the guys who was involved in the backdoor vote thing where Ohio was having their votes tabulated in Kentucky or
no, you're close.
Yeah, okay.
Clint wrote the program in Florida to flip the machines.
Oh, that's right. We had him on this program.
He testified in front of Congress.
Right. So, you will find in the archives of this program, you will find my interviewing Clint Curtis. I remember him now. Sure.
Yeah. I spoke to him more recently, and he said the scanners can also be hacked.
Sure.
Not just the voting machines.
Yeah. I know that. And the scanners should be open source software, and they should be government owned machines. Rather than closed source software and government leased machines, and we should be doing this on paper so that there's a paper trail that can be audited. This should not be rocket science.
I think it should be all paper and counted right at the polling place.
Yeah, I don't disagree.
I a Democrat, Republican, and neutral.
Yeah,
I'm all in one place.
I am totally with you, Howard. Thank you for the call. I totally share your perspective. Tom in Cathedral City, California, got a minute to the break. Tom, what's up?
Hey, my question is about the privatization of the of everything.
Mm-hmm.
Of all the things you mentioned, how much money of our budget goes towards all that?
A lot. I frankly don't know, but it wouldn't surprise me if you're talking about non-discretionary spending, you know, or if you're talking about discretionary spending rather, the stuff that's not, you know, Social Security, that kind of thing.
Things we don't really do.
Yeah. Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me to find that it's as much as half. I mean, I don't know. But if 70% of our intelligence budget has been outsourced, if you look at the amount of money that we spent on outsourced things in Afghanistan and Iraq, it in some cases exceeded the military expenditures, so it's more than half. So it could be as much as half. I mean, most of our vote has been outsourced, almost all of it. It's just wrong. I mean, it's just wrong. It's so wrong. Tom, thanks a lot for the call. Excellent question. Somebody should be compiling that information. To what extent have our commons been stolen from us? We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Really, seriously, this is an issue that's worth calling your member of Congress about. Let's end the voting machines being owned by private companies. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you 15 minutes before the hour. And Joe watching Free Speech TV in Bronx, New York. Hey, Joe, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. It's City Island, but it is.
Oh, City Island. Okay.
Two issues around the voting machines. One, back in 2004, my husband and I went down to Orlando to do Election Protection, which was a nonpartisan group.
Mm-hmm.
And the exit polls, which had previously never been wrong by 1%, by a margin of even 1% showed Kerry ahead. We went to bed pretty blasted ecstatic, and then we were catching a plane to New York the next morning. We turned on the news before we had to go to the airport, and lo and behold, it had flipped.
Yep.
And you know, and
these were electronic voting machines.
The scary thing is that we picked up a Daily News when we came home, and there was this picture of Karl Rove in the basement of the White House with this evil leer on his face, looking at a computer screen. Like, aha, we did it. Yeah. And it just gave me the chills.
Which, you know? Was that the 2004 election?
Yeah. We were in Orlando. Oh my gosh, we were supposed to be nonpartisan, so we were, and all we had was, it was like a middle, even maybe upper middle class, mostly Hispanic district, someplace southwest of the airport. Mm-hmm. They were so enthused. Those guys stood out in the 80 and 90 degree sun. They weren't even allowed in the auditorium in the 90 degree heat so that they could vote. They were there at 6 in the morning. I mean, it was like unbelievable. We were so glad that we had gone down, and we thought, okay, you know, this made a difference. And then the machines beat it.
If there was ever an election in America that was almost certainly hacked, it was the 2004 election.
Yeah, that was our feeling. I was just sort of sick to my stomach, you know, the rest of the day, especially when I saw that picture of Carl. But anyway, now today, you know, we did our preliminary election. We got to use our good old lever machines, which are foolproof. I've worked on the polls. Everything tallies. You can't hack it. It's dependable. And then they went back to the electronic things. And when we went to the poll, which was, a couple hours after they'd been open, my friends that were working the poll said, what a mess. The sheets, which first of all were in 7 font, which is kind of hard to even read, they came and they weren't perforated, so they tried to cut them with a paper cutter, but then, you know, if you've ever tried to fax or scan something or put something in the printer, and if it wasn't exactly even, it jammed. Mm. The machines were jamming. Nobody's votes were counting, and they actually had to have a repairman in by 7:15 in the morning.
Wow.
This
is in New York.
And, in New York, yeah. This is City Hall in Bronx.
Yeah. This is insane, you know.
And I don't know what was happening everywhere else. All I know is about that. Oh, actually, I was riding home in Manhattan on the bus late last night, and there were two poll workers coming from Manhattan precincts, and they were just talking about all the problems, too, and all of us.
And this is all on the altar of privatization.
Yeah,
I mean,
all on the altar of privatization, and they're calling it a different name that's making those machines, but it's Diebold.
Yeah. It's Diebold, ES, Sequoia, all these companies. Joe, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for sharing your story. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Harbin here with you. And Ron in Chicago. Hey, Ron, you wanted to talk about voting machines? Ron? Okay, let's try Mitch in Sycamore, Illinois. We'll stay in the same general area.
Oh, I know, we got it quick.
How you doing, Mitch?
Hey, I voted in Iowa for caucuses. Mm-hmm. It's actually equivalent to instant runoff voting, and there's no electronics, no paper.
Because you're all just standing there.
You say, this guy, this guy, this guy. Oh, we don't have enough for you. Find a new voter.
Right.
Within 2 hours, it's all done. It's all counted. All they have to do is write just a few numbers, usually for 2 or 3 candidates, down on a piece of paper, it's over, it's out in the state, it's on the news in hours.
Yeah, this is like in Vermont, New Hampshire, the go-to-meeting day, you know, the town go-to-meeting, I think that's the name of it. But
absolutely loved it, because it's like instant runoff voting.
Yeah, it's a good thing, and we should have instant runoff voting. Mitch, thanks a lot for the call. Excellent point. And a good one. George in Keyport, New Jersey. Hey, George, what's on your mind today? Thanks for listening to WWR.
How you doing, Tom? Great. I just wanted to talk about the governor's election we had here in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm disappointed in the New Jersey voters that they did not see through Chris Christie's smokescreen. If and when he does run for president, he's not going to have much of a record to run on, because his flagship point during the whole election was that he held down property taxes for everybody, but in some cases, some people's property taxes went up as much as 10%. Another issue is he's done nothing to help the people that were unemployed, and I was one of them for almost 2 years. And also, he is he took so long to get the Republican Congress to give money for the people that were harmed by Hurricane Sandy last year.
Yeah.
It took him 66 days to call out the Republican Congress, and I heard on your show that when they had Hurricane Katrina, they had federal aid in about 2 weeks, and also when they had the tornadoes in the Midwest, they had aid very, very quickly.
Yeah.
So he's got no record to run on, and I think the voters in the country will see that, although the New Jersey voters didn't see that yesterday.
I don't think so, George. I think that Chris Christie's going to do he's going to do a Ronald Reagan. He is going to be, he's a hard right-winger who occasionally will throw a bone to the Democrats, will wave that around as if he's some kind of a moderate, will use moderate rhetoric, will talk in dog whistle to his core supporters, but everybody else won't get it. He'll smile a lot. He'll be very vague a lot. And then when he becomes president, if he becomes president, he'll do incredible damage to this country. I see Christie as the next Ronald Reagan. The one thing that I wonder about, George, thank you for the call, is that Ronald Reagan wouldn't have been president if he hadn't gotten the Iranians to hold the hostages, you know, for that whole year, for 440 days, actually, 444 days. He cut that deal, and it blows my mind. You can right now go on the Christian Science Monitor's website, the a good, credible newspaper, and here's an article, and this is in March of this year, in response to the movie Argo by President Bonnie Sauter, who was elected president in 1980. In the summer of 1980, he was elected president of Iran on the platform of I'm going to free the hostages. He won. He went to the Ayatollahs and he said, okay, it's time to free the hostages. I won. Over 90% of the people who voted for a free the hostages candidate. The average Iranian did not want to keep the hostages. And in fact, this is why he's complaining about the movie Argo, because he says it mischaracterizes Iran. And the Ayatollahs said, no, we can't let go of the hostages because we cut a deal with Ronald Reagan to hold the hostages until after the election. And the spare parts are already being delivered by Israel. The tires have already started to arrive. Can't do it. And the president of Iran writes an op-ed in an American newspaper, and it does not get picked up by the media, pointing out that the only way Ronald Reagan won the White House was by treason. And we know now that Nixon won in 68 by treason, by blowing up the Vietnam negotiations. That was just released 3 years ago in the White House tapes. You got Reagan doing it by treason. You got Nixon doing it by treason. And then you got George W. Bush. The only way that he became president is his brother threw 80,000 African-Americans off the voting rolls weeks before the election in Florida, so that he could get within spitting distance of having the Supreme Court decide the case for him. So there hasn't really been a legitimate Republican president elected since Dwight Eisenhower, without the use of treason or something close to it. So the question in my mind is, if Chris Christie runs in 2016 and he runs using that Reagan strategy of I am a moderate, I'm the good guy, I smile nicely, how's he going to, that wasn't enough to get Reagan. Reagan was still running 5-6 points behind before the hostages were taken. What kind of foreign policy disaster is Chris Christie going to, John McCain tried to do this on behalf of Mitt Romney? I believe it was in the election of 2000. It was the election of 2008. John McCain went over to Yalta, and Karl Rove went over to Yalta and met with Saakashvili, the president of Georgia, the former Soviet Republic, president of Georgia. And a couple of months later, here's Saakashvili having this war with South Ossetia and Abkhazistan, as I recall, and who are friendly to Russia. So basically, he's having a war with Russia. And John McCain is running around getting hysterical about this and trying to use it in the campaign John McCain was running against Barack Obama in that race. John McCain was running, trying to use it to his benefit. And I think that Karl Rove set that thing up. In fact, he was supposed to be testifying. Nancy Pelosi had subpoenaed him to testify before Congress that day. And instead, he was in Yalta meeting with Saakashvili. He should have gone to jail for this. So, but, you know, call me a conspiracy. They try. These Republicans, they try this every single time. Coming up tomorrow, all the news and anything breaking on the elections. Plus, Mike Capitonio from Ring of Fire Radio is going to be here. And Faith Healing or Homicide. We'll have the latest on the status of that issue. Cameron Stout, author of In the Name of God. Plus, my weekly favorite, Geeky Science. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It begins with you. Our new book, The Crash of 2016, is out. And check out lasthours.org. Tag your it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.